Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. Carol Adams' revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, was released back in 1990. The book explains the concept of the absent referent. Quote, "Behind every meal of meat is an absence, the death of the animal whose place the meat takes. This is the absent referent. The function of the absent referent is to keep our meat separated from any idea that she or he was once an animal, to keep something from being seen as having been someone, to allow for the moral abandonment of another being," end quote. Well, an updated 35th anniversary edition of The Sexual Politics of Meat was recently released with a new introduction that reflects recent events. Carol Adams recently gave a Bloomsbury lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. She asks, what can meat eating tell us about Western authoritarians? What can ICE recruitment ads tell us about settler colonialism and its relationship to eating animals? Carol Adams discusses everything from the Trump administration's masculine meat agenda under RFK Jr. to Viktor Orban boasting about the increased per capita consumption of meat in Hungary. Carol Adams is a feminist advocate, activist, and independent scholar fighting against sexual violence, racism, and homelessness, and fighting for reproductive justice and fair housing. She is the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, which is now available in an updated 35th anniversary edition. The sequel and visual companion is called The Pornography of Meat. Carol Adams is also author and editor of many more books, including Neither Man Nor Beast, Feminism and the Defense of Animals, and Never Too Late to Go Vegan, the Over 50 Guide to Adopting and Thriving on a Plant-Based Diet. Hi, Carol. Congratulations on the 35th anniversary, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, and thank you for addressing this important issue in these special reports.
Well, I just wonder, Carol, I watched your incredible lecture, The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times, and I wonder, what has it been like for you to see your book change and evolve over the past 35 years?
Well, I had the original idea for the book back in 1974, and so I'd been living with it for a while before it was published, and before I felt like I'd gotten together all the ideas in a coherent way to make a book work. And I remember when it came out thinking, am I observing something that's passing away? Because at that point, you know, there were many more vegetarian restaurants. The word vegan was emerging, though anybody who was a vegan back then will remember that your Word documents always underlined vegan as though it was a misspelling. But I really thought, oh, am I too late? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that happened with the book is people started sending me examples immediately, visual news articles from around the world. And I would say it is stunning to see where we are now. I would like to have written a book that no longer mattered, mm-hmm. but with RFK and Trump and with authoritarians worldwide, especially in Europe, meat is something they really want to hang their hat on. Meat is something they want to brag about. And it has to do with them being seen as strong men. And so I don't get depressed. I want to continue to argue and fight with a world, a patriarchal, flesh-eating world. So I kind of sigh and add yet another example to my bulging file.
Well, it's incredible to think that 50 years ago, you realized that there was a connection between feminism and vegetarianism, meat eating, and a patriarchal culture. And here we are in 2026, and you just gave a lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. How did you come up with the concept behind your new lecture? When did you start thinking about this?
The night that Trump was elected. Ginny Messina and I wrote a book called Protest Kitchen. And it is a book that we wrote for progressives, especially to show if you care about the environment, if you care about human rights, if you care about feminism, if you care about compassion, here are reasons for you to consider being vegan, and here are steps to do that. Now, back in 2017, we wanted to call that book The Anti-Trump Diet. And it was sent out as a book proposal to publishers by our agent. And many of them said he's not going to be around for long. So I've always joked and said it's the only book of mine that's been rejected out of optimism. So on the night that Trump was elected in 2024, I sat down and started to write a letter about all the ways that the sexual politics of meat was inter had been interacting with the Trump campaign. For instance, the way Vance and then Trump ostracized and animalized the immigrants in Ohio because they were eating the cats, eating the dogs. That's an example of the sexual politics of meat in the sense that the people that they're classifying, they're trying to show that they are closer to being animal-like so that they don't have human rights. And one way you show that is by showing that they do things we don't. We being, sort of so-called normal Americans, quotes around both of those words. So from the moment that Vance said that, I just started keeping a file. Of course, it had entered into the 2020 election too, because it was said that Biden and Kamala were going to take away your beef. So it's always been an important ra rallying cry, eat the right kind of dead animals, and you'll be seen as being like us. Eat the wrong kind, and oh, no, shows you're animal like yourself.
And before we get into examples, and you share so many in your lecture, I wanted to talk about what you hear from a lot of liberals and people on the left, and you do address this in your talk. They say that veganism is a personal choice, not a collective responsibility. And you say, I see veganism as needing a collective response. Climate change is happening to all of us. You point out that Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, and we've had them on the show, who wrote that book, In How Democracies Die, say that unlike totalitarians who want obedient participation, authoritarians cultivate passivity. They write, authoritarian regimes want their citizens to keep their heads down and their mouths shut. They should focus on their private lives, not concern themselves with public affairs. If totalitarianism is for joiners, authoritarianism is for the apathetic. And in your lecture, you say, I know many progressives and good liberals cast veganism as a personal choice and then say it's hard to change. So, can you explain why you think this is really more about a collective response than an individual choice?
Well, I can think of several reasons. In Sexual Politics of Meat, I quote Cato, who said, "It is hard, O citizens, to speak to a stomach that has no ears." And sometimes that's what I feel I'm doing. Like a New York Times article that has appeared this week about RFK Jr. and meat eating, and the author says she likes her steak medium rare or whatever. There's no shame associated with making that proclamation. And yet we know how extensively meat production influences climate change. So, first of all, there's no people can embrace meat eating with impunity. They might have to experience a little embarrassment if they're eating with a vegan, but then they look and think, well, that vegan's pretty unhappy. Look how angry they are right now. And at least I get it to eat a hamburger. I don't want to be an unhappy vegan. I think the second thing is a lack of imagination. Almost anything I know about can be veganized. And what people say to me, because I'll often do, you know, what I sort of silently think of as vegan propaganda meals, where I have people over and I don't make a, they all know I'm vegan, but I don't say this is vegan, that is vegan. But what they all say to me is, well, I'd be vegan if you'd cook for me. And so it's really like, well, let's get together and I'll teach you to cook. You know, it's an update to the terribly carnivorous, you know, teach a person, give a person a fish and they eat for a day, a dead fish, give them the means to catch fish and they eat for their lives. Well, why don't we update that? Give a person the ability to know how to cook vegan, and it can be life-changing because every vegan can help change other people. People think veganism is hard. Not changing is harder. I mean, one of the things, I don't do this often, but I was in an ice cream shop in Baltimore, and somebody in front of me was talking about something. So I just said, you know, 25% of cows are pregnant when they're slaughtered. And she said, don't tell me. People already know when they say, don't tell me, don't remind me. I think everybody has an awareness of what it means when they're eating flesh that someone else has suffered, but they don't want to be reminded. They don't, you know, the stomach wants to have no ears. Don't tell me. So, and the final reason is progressives could so take this step of just saying, let's have all our meals be vegan. Let's just do vegan potlucks, bring recipes. Let's have a collective response. Climate change is a collective concern. Someday I hope ethical, our ethics expands to beyond the species line. But why not have potlucks where we exchange and share and we help other people grow into veganism? People have accepted the way the right wing has presented it almost. Oh, I need it for this, I need it for that. They don't realize that it's probably in their eating habits that they most resemble the right wing activists that they the rest of their lives are opposing in their activism and their writing.
On today's Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series, we are spending the hour with Carol Adams, who wrote the groundbreaking revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, back in 1990. It was recently released with an updated 35th anniversary edition and a new introduction. Carol recently gave a Bloomsbury lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. And in this talk, she has so many incredible examples of authoritarians, like Viktor Orban, for example, boasting about the increased per capita consumption of meat in Hungary. So let's dive in and talk about some of the things that you brought out in your lecture, Carol. You write that it's a hard time to be mortal in this world with Trump 2.0 and the authoritarianism that's been spreading around the world and in the United States. And you write about what authoritarianism is. You also add five themes related to the sexual politics of meat. So if we can go over some of these, you write about meat manhood and Western authoritarianism, white manhood, white supremacy, and meat and dairy, settler colonialism, meat and dairy and white supremacy, the real and symbolic value of animal oppression, and progressive resistance requires a reckoning with veganism. So tell us about some of the things that you uncovered that were just so kind of surprising to you. I mean, I think it's fascinating to learn that. You read about Poland's right-wing Law and Justice Party. They've used threats to meat eating as a way to excite their followers, associating veganism with the neo-left and gender advocates. And in 2019, three vegan restaurants were vandalized with neo-Nazi imagery and slogans that said, "White power, we will F you up," and "Homo is deviancy." What else did you uncover that surprised you?
I think my bar for being surprised is pretty high these days, just because some of it just seems so predictable. But why don't let's just talk about milk drinking for a minute. We have accepted the idea that cow's milk is healthy and pure and has the nutrients we need. And so the MAHA movement has claimed, fresh whole milk. But before there was MAHA, there were white supremacists tweeting about drinking milk. So that one of the tweets that I showed included this statement: "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for lactose tolerant children." It's granted, it's a mouthful, but people need to know that wording is a paraphrase of what is known as the 14, which is a white supremacist slogan in 14 words that asserts we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. So many people might not know that to digest milk, you need a certain enzyme. 65% of the world is estimated to be lactose intolerant. That enzyme more likely is carried in the bodies of people who are white, people who are from Europe, than people of color. So a diet that has never actually represented the majority world was accepted as an appropriate diet to promote, for instance, in the United States. And for many, many years, dairy has, there's a promise from the federal government to cap the price of dairy. If it goes over that, then the federal government buys it up. That's why so much cheese and milk gets dumped into prisons or public schools. And I'll just put that aside. If we have time, I'll go back to what the impact of that is on kids of color and prisoners of color. But as a result, because of this question of who's lactose tolerant and who isn't, it became a symbol of white racial purity. And the right wing would take milk cartons to Trump rallies. They had hashtags like milk Twitter and milk nationalism. So besides the terrible experience of dairy cows, probably one of the worst things we can do to animals, which includes forcibly making them pregnant, taking away their calf before even the colostrum has been able to be sucked from their bodies, milk becomes associated with white people because they're the ones who can digest it. And the alt-right has used that for years, and they show images of themselves with their, buff arms and toasting each other with milk. If you look at recent examples released from the Department of Health, you'll find, for instance, a video of RFK Jr. with Kid Rock, and they're looking buff in exactly the same way. They're echoing these alt-right, right-wing, white supremacist posts. And at the end of their exercise routine, where, of course, their RFK is in blue jeans and he has nothing covering his chest, he and Kid Rock toast each other with whole milk. And that's the whole message. So they're not. They have absorbed the claims of right-wing white supremacists. They've absorbed it and now they're promoting it. There is nothing that is in milk taken from a cow that is necessary for human beings.
And Carol, it was so interesting to learn in your talk that the drinking of the nursing labor of cows accelerated after the 2008 election of Barack Obama. As you say, an anxious and unsettled white masculinity needed to reclaim its status. I'm guessing that a lot of this is very new to our listeners. So, can you tell us what you saw after the election of Obama?
So in the sexual politics of meat, I talk about the mythology, the cultural mythology that men need meat, that meat makes you more masculine, meat makes you stronger, virile. And so the idea is that vegetables or vegetable protein is feminizing or weakening. So we already had that dialectic, in a sense, before the election of Obama. But with Obama's election, you've got to use the word triggering. Oh my God, these white supremacists were all triggered. An African American person has become president of the United States. So what I found was suddenly, and it wasn't just the right wing, the mainstream all was, there'd be these images of how the father and the son built a barbecue together and then had meat from it. That was from Family Handyman, or Eat Like a Man on the cover of various muscle magazines. There was this resurgence of the equation of meat and masculinity. And a couple other things about that. There have always been ads that say sort of man up and eat your meat, or renew your man card. I think from the moment of a second wave feminism in the early 1970s, late 60s, the threat to masculinity always has needed something symbolic to hold it in place, as it were. So, I only have to renew my library card every 3 years. But these poor men, if they decide to eat oatmeal for breakfast instead of bacon and eggs, well, they've got to renew their man card. It shows how fragile masculinity is, and also that the need for the gender binary. The sexual politics of meat is one of the mythologies that keeps the gender binary in place. So the idea of this very liberal, handsome man who could even wear tan suits being the president, it just sent them all. I mean, it just radicalized, I think, the right wing in a way that could be expressed through milk drinking and posting about all the meat they were eating.
And just a couple more examples. In your lecture, you talk about how during Trump's first term, Richard Spencer, the originator of the term alt-right, posted, "I'm very tolerant, lactose tolerant." You have this incredible video of Great Britain's Nigel Farage kind of whining about the milk options he has when he's drinking coffee, like oat milk and almond milk. What is that? I just want milk. And then this history that you include, Carol. Fascists have used cow's lactation product as a rallying cry for white supremacy for almost a century. It was in Mussolini's public health campaigns and in the German Nazis' promotion of cow's milk.
Yeah, I mean, it's look at milk. It's sold as this pure thing, this whiteness. It's a mirror. It's a mirror to whiteness. Back in the 90s, the NAACP and Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine sued the USDA, saying that their food charts were racist because they recommended milk. So back to those kids. So imagine an African American child being fed meals at public schools that have a lot of cheese and milk. And then you start to feel really uncomfortable because you don't have the enzyme that's going to digest it. And you start moving around in your seat. And so then we hear how, especially it was in the 90s, African American kids were just so hard to teach. And nobody was looking at what are we giving them to eat? But instead, what we have is this reclamation of a food that was not the food of most people till at the most 200 years ago.
Well, this is so fascinating. After a break, we'll talk about this, about settler colonialism and how, cattle was actually brought to this country. What else would you like to tell us about what the research has shown about how dairy has really affected children of color in schools and how it's affected people who are behind bars, people who are people of color who are behind bars?
If you can't digest dairy, if you lack that, you're going to be at the minimum very uncomfortable. So I mean, one thing I think we should acknowledge is that there were always have always been a close relationship between meat companies and the federal government. This is why cattle were allowed to range on public land. We called them welfare cowboys because at that time, women on welfare were being called welfare queens. So we called them welfare kings. And this guarantee of keeping the price of dairy down, the federal protections protect meat production so that many of the costs to the environment are carried by everybody and not by the meat producer. And the USDA's recommendations from the 1950s that were practically written by the meat companies. When you look at RFK's new chart, there's no tofu on it. So it's tied with this sort of unbearable whiteness of milk on all levels, is also the presumption that we can trust the federal government to make the right decisions for us about food. And then as well, that the presumption that the foods we eat in the United States, this heavy meat and dairy diet, is the perfect diet, when it is really only the inertia of not stepping outside of the propaganda of the government and the meat companies together. When my son was in second grade, all his information on food came, all the handouts said at the bottom, courtesy of the dairy industry. It also goes to help explain why it's hard for progressives to give up eating dead animals and the lactation product of cows. People learn that they are eating dead animals only after they have been eating dead animals, usually. They're being fed dead animals as 1-year-olds and 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds. And by the time they ask about it, they've already acclimated to the taste of it. And if they ask about it, they might be told, oh, well, the animals don't suffer, or that's why the animals are here. I think for people to embrace veganism, they have to, the first step is to say, I understand I was lied to.
Carol, before we go to break, this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take calls, but we're definitely going to have Carol back to take calls. Whenever we do shows about adding more fruits and vegetables to your diet, we get a lot of people calling in saying that they either tried veganism or vegetarianism and it didn't work, and they feel that their body needs meat and or dairy. What would you say to them?
Well, it reminds me of when I started to meditate. Imagine me going up to, a Buddhist monk and say, oh, well, I tried it and it didn't work. Well, try it a different way. There isn't one way to move away from dependence on slaughtered animals and captive cows. If that didn't work, what could work? Use your imagination too. If it is that you feel you need, I mean, sometimes people say, oh, I missed my steak. Well, maybe what you missed was iron. I don't know. When people talk to me, those are the kinds of suggestions or questions I will ask. Well, how did you try it? Well, I tried it for a week and I ate salads. Well, no, I'm not asking you to eat salad at every meal. I'm just asking you to figure out anything that you love that is non-vegan, I suspect can be veganized. And some of us have had lots of fun doing it. But at this point, even if everybody just stopped eating burgers made from animals and started eating plant-based burgers. Or if people who are afraid to go vegan said, I will eat vegan whenever I eat out, or I'll eat vegan when I'm at home. Some people think they can't change, but how do they try to change if they're trying to change in a way that proves they can't, so they can get back to whatever it is? If you're the New York Times reporter, you want your steak or whatever. Oh, there was an article, I think, in Atlantic or New York magazine, one of these magazine articles that trumpet the death of veganism, that where the reporter said, well, now I can eat foie gras without feeling guilty because meat is back. And I thought, the goal isn't to make you feel guilty, it's to feel empathy. I don't care about your guilt, I care about empathy. If you are open to feeling empathy across the species barrier, and as you know in my talk, I said compassion should not have a border. We shouldn't be patrolling the borders of compassion. If that is driving you, you'll figure it out. I didn't know how to cook when I became a vegetarian, but other people taught me. And now I can teach other people. I've been vegan for probably 34 years, 35 years. People taught me. When I'd speak on college campuses, the students would tell me what they were cooking. I'd go home and try on. There are so many people willing to help others, non-vegans, figure it out. You don't need to walk away just because you think you need that. If you're open enough to try it, use both your imagination and your intelligence to solve the problem of what it is you need to eat.
Well, we're going to take a quick break on today's Your Calls Authoritarian Playbook series. We are spending the hour with Carol Adams, who wrote the revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, back in 1990. An updated 35th anniversary edition was recently released with a new introduction that reflects recent events. Carol Adams recently gave a Bloomsbury lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. She asks, what can meat eating tell us about Western authoritarians? What can ICE recruitment ads tell us about settler colonialism and its relationship to eating animals? This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Carol Adams, who wrote the revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, back in 1990. An updated 35th anniversary edition with a new introduction was recently released, and Carol just gave a lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. Carol, let's talk a little bit about gender, because in your talk, you also talk about why authoritarians rely on the gender binary, reinforcing very strict gender and sexual hierarchies where women are subjugated to men. So talk about what you wrote about in The Sexual Politics of Meat, and then how you brought that into your talk about the sexual politics of meat in authoritarian times.
In The Sexual Politics of Meat, I talk about how the gender binary is reinforced or seen as fixed by the help of assumptions about who eats what. Men eat meat. This reassures everyone. Men eat meat, and so the world is fine. Women could eat meat or they don't need to eat meat. It all depends. But if there's not enough meat, they are the ones who would give it up. You know, the meat is for the man. Since The Sexual Politics of Meat came out, you've seen a resurgence in steakhouses, and they're often described as men, you know, very male imbued atmosphere, dark wood and darkness and all these accoutrements that reinforce the idea that manhood exists here. Lots of ads have always, you know, they've joked about it, you know, men need meat, and they've also been very serious about it. All the Carl's Jr. ads where there was a buxom woman eating a big hamburger, very salacious. There was one that almost implied where she's walking through a farmer's market that men are ejaculating because it's through the hose. And, you know, one of the signs of the influence of Trump and the right wing is that for the first time, Carl's Jr. developed an ad around the Super Bowl after Trump's re-election. Anyway, gender is supposed to be fixed, and women are supposed to eat less meat than men. I just was talking to a young man here in Dallas, and of course, Dallas is going to have lots of steakhouses. But he told me that when he was out to dinner a couple weeks ago, and he had ordered a fillet, and he was laughed at because it wasn't a big enough piece of dead flesh. That a fillet should, you know, that's a woman's meal. So it continues to be tinged with testosterone, as it were. At the same time, one of the things that's happened with authoritarianism worldwide, there have been assaults on gender studies. There is no desire to have consciousness around gender. Consciousness around gender is a very threatening thing. Patriarchal politics require, you know, well, what have we been told recently? Two are one and the one is the man. That's why the man should vote for both of them. The notion of patriarchal hierarchy, there's the man who is the head of the household and there's the woman. And those parallel the kind of authoritarian regimes where there is one strong man and everyone else listens to him. So patriarchal social relations want women who are obedient. One of the interesting things is that women are strongly anti-authoritarian in ways that threaten authoritarian governments. So to find ways to limit the ability of women to speak out or protest is one way to shore up authoritarianism. Another thing that has been found by Harvard scholars were that authoritarian states share a reduction in penalties for domestic or sexual violence against women. I mean, the kind of convulsions we're feeling in the US about the Epstein files is that how he was not pursued, how he was allowed to settle, and all of the people implicated. One of the things I didn't use in the talk was I took screenshots of every damn man who said he regretted his association. Regret, regret, regret. You know what? Really? You benefited from the association. So authoritarians want women not to benefit from association. They want women subjugated and separate and also pregnant or able. Do not let women decide the fate of their pregnancies. One of the things I didn't talk about in that lecture, but that we should really be aware of, is that there are anti-choice imagery in animal agriculture, especially the pharmaceutical companies, where they'd show a pig dressed very sexually, eyelashes and, you know, buxom and painted trotter nails. And it said, you know, that she wanted to give one more piglet per year to the farmer. The female animals are dying to be pregnant on behalf of the farmer who's, you know, then selling their babies to meat eaters. So the resurgence of meat at this time is so clearly tied to both the goal of stopping the upheaval that's caused manhood to be threatened. And it is also a way that Western authoritarians especially say, look what we've done for you. You know, meat eating is up. You're able to get so much more meat. We aren't flaky. We aren't feminine. We aren't going to let you down. We aren't like those urbanites. And about Nigel Farage, complaining about all he wanted was bloody milk. I joked afterwards with my Bloomsbury editor. I said, I want to know what hotel he was in London. That's a hotel I want to go to if it's got both oat milk and almond milk.
Well, this is such an important one when you talk about reproduction, because you write about the connection between the oppression of women and animals. You write that animal agriculture's absolute control of reproduction breeds a language of entitlement that carries oblique or explicit anti-abortion references from Bo is it Bovi Shield or Bovi Shield? This
Yeah,
is a
Bovie Shield.
BoviShield, it's a pharmaceutical company with an ad campaign that asks the questions about a cow. If she can't stay pregnant, what else will she do?
Right. It's that one is remarkable
Wow.
because the presumption is, of course, that the cow exists to be pregnant. It isn't about the cow so much as that it's not so much about the pregnancy for the cow. She has to get pregnant so that she has milk to be taken from her. People's understanding of mammalian biology is so weak. They think, oh, we're just taking the extra milk. We're not taking the milk from the baby. My God, really, you've accepted all the farm propaganda that these cows are happy and willing participants. And the Bovie Shield was one of those ads. But I want to tell you about a cartoon that was just in the New Yorker, and it made me so sick I had to close it. And it showed what it was like an egg has become an omelet, and he's thinking or she's thinking, but I want it to be, like a hard boiled egg or something. And the reason I see that as an anti-abortion image, and there was an ad like that where an egg is shown imagining itself as a McDonald's breakfast sandwich, is that it imputes consciousness to the unborn. And then the animal agriculture aspect of it is not, and that consciousness is to serve humans. That egg wants to serve and be eaten by humans. As we know, no one has consciousness of non-existence. If you don't exist, you don't have consciousness that you don't exist. But these are very slippery areas where sort of an anti-abortion presumption that's so implicit, people don't realize they're participating in it. Here's another interesting aspect of animal agriculture at this point. After Dobbs was overturned in 2022, there's apparently a survey company that's been surveying opinions about abortion for decades. And one of the questions they asked was, do women's eggs have shells? And 22% of the respondents in the summer of 2022 did not know the answer. So animal agriculture has so influenced our ideas about eggs that people are, one fifth of the population that was interviewed did not know that about women.
Wow.
So the suppression of women's ability to make decisions about reproduction, or the decision of anyone who could be pregnant to make that, to have the right to end a pregnancy, is an important part of authoritarianism.
Today, we're speaking with Carol Adams, who wrote the incredible revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, back in 1990. An updated 35th anniversary edition with a new introduction was recently released. And Carol just gave a Bloomsbury lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. Carol, well, we're going to have you back because we only have about 5 minutes left. So we don't have enough time really to talk about indigenous lands, but I do want to mention this because I think it's so important what you talk about in your lecture. The West was not won, it was stolen from indigenous nations through genocide, land theft, and erase and replace displacement of native nations. And it's so easy to forget that cattle were used to accomplish this. Dairy farming and cattle consumption is a result of settler colonialism. And you point out that the Department of Homeland Security is putting on their social media pages this romanticized image of settler colonialism, that 1872 painting that glorifies Manifest Destiny, the white supremacist doctrine that justified, quote, winning the West. And this is so related to what you're talking about here, because 80% of ag land is used for meat and dairy production, and this is on stolen land and native land. So that's really important to focus on. We'll talk more about that when we bring you back live. But why don't we end the show by talking about how you end your lecture? You say that kindness is a way to express hope. Let's not erect a border around compassion, excluding other species. Can you talk about how this way of living really helps you handle your despair at rising authoritarianism?
Thank you. Yes, I think I first learned this when I was a caregiver to my mother at the beginning of the 21st century. She had Alzheimer's, and there were some very difficult days, but every night I could turn to my vegan meal and think, this is an affirmation of me as a caring person. And this is a beautiful meal. I could look at the colors or enjoy the taste. The vegan meal became an anchor in my life, reminding me why I care, that I care, and sort of affirming my decision. And when I was working on the lecture, I thought, that's how it's working now too. I can cook something beautiful and share it with other people. We're all feeling pain, but we need to eat, and we need to eat well at this time.
Right.
There are going to be no King's marches for the future, I'm sure. There's going to be other ways that we help, whether we're monitoring ICE in court outside of courthouse courtrooms, helping friends, family, neighbors in so many different ways. Why not dine in a way that affirms who you are and says, every day you get to return to this. You get to return to this beautiful bounty of salads or mushroom burgers or vegan spanakopita, whatever it is that you want to make. And you can celebrate. This is a moment. Just set aside this time to take care of yourself. So I see veganism. I also think that veganism is just a way to say, I understand that my caring can grow. I don't have to silo my caring into just this one area. But that there's this wonderful prayer that I was given in Sanskrit that says, take perfect from perfect and perfect remains. And I like to think that's what compassion and caring is. We can give compassion out, and it will there will always be compassion. And I know we all have to restore, so let's restore with compassion. Why do we retreat to houses after being activists and then display a failure to care? No cow wants her calf taken away from her. No animal wants to die. No pig wants to give birth in a gestation crate. It doesn't take a great deal of thought to think about what we're demanding of animals for us to stay apathetic. And authoritarians want us to be apathetic. So let's not keep our mouths shut about this.
Well, and also the other thing that we learned in your lecture is that Black Americans are the fastest growing demographic adopting veganism in the United States. Studies show they are three times as likely to be vegan or vegetarian compared to the general population, which is so interesting. We'll definitely have to do a show about that.
It shows the racism of reports that veganism is dying. Because what, how are they measuring that trend? They're measuring that trend through wide eyes.
Carol Adams wrote the revolutionary book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegan Critical Theory, back in 1990. An updated 35th anniversary with a new introduction recently came out, and she just gave a Bloomsbury lecture called The Sexual Politics of Meat in Authoritarian Times. Carol, thank you so much for your incredible work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much, Rose, for your attention to these issues.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Authoritarian Playbook Series.